of the things I love most about hosting this podcast is that I get to meet and spend time with some of the great military leaders of this nation. General James T. Conway is a four-star general and was a commandant of the Marine Corps. He was appointed by George W. Bush president from 2006 to 2010, 4 years, and commanded 60,000 troops in two combat tours that he had in Iraq. He now serves on the board of XG Technology. Welcome, General Conway. General, we've known each other a while, and we both struggled with energy security for America. And you're on the Energy Security Leadership Council, and you're also on servicing America's future energy, securing America's future energy safe.
Check.
So you have two groups that you work with, and you just released recommendations telling us what and why. And would you just take off from there and kind of tell me and take 3 or 4 minutes?
Yeah. Boone, let me quickly set the background for the need for the report. And that is a belief on the part of the Energy Security Leadership Council that national security is the issue here regards our petroleum requirements and supply. It is not a free market. It's a manipulated market. The U.S. is at the bottom of a puppeteer pulling the strings, and that puppeteer is the OPEC institution or organization led by the Saudis, who recently instituted a national strategy to flood the market with oil for a multitude of reasons. One, to go against their regional adversary, Iran, and make sure their oil comes on the market at a reduced price. But I think equally important is to undercut the effort that we've seen taking place in our country over the last 2 or 3 years now, that's starting to both provide additional oil onto the global market, but also sort of the parallel effort, and that is to find alternative fuels, which is what SAFE is all about, so that we can lessen our dependence. Our dependence today in the transportation market is 92% on petroleum products. We import about 30%. That used to be 60, but now it's about 30%. That's down and that's good, but it's still way too much.
You say our imports.
Our imports. Are today
but
about 30%.
We're also exporting.
We are exporting different kinds of oil.
4 million barrels of, of product, refined products, are going out every day.
And you know that better than anybody, so there is that give and take, and that's fine where a free market is at work, and we can both produce sufficiently for export but also import different kinds of quality oil for what the nation needs. So with all that in mind, and with an understanding that the United States of America, with its oil reserves, natural gas reserves, and coal reserves is the biggest energy powerhouse on the planet. And yet we don't have a national energy plan.
But let me interject something here. That if you look at the world, there have been 5 million wells plus drilled in the world. Over half of them in the United States. Why? When I got out of school in 51, geologists, over 90% of the oil found to that date had been found by American geologists, geophysicists, engineers. Now, here we are, 2016, and guess what? 90% of all the oil found is by American technicians. I mean, it's so clear that we are superior to everybody else in the world.
The problem that we're experiencing right now, and again, I'm talking to the choir here, I realize, is that if you look at the cost per barrel for production, the Saudis are hanging around $10 or so. Ours are up in the range of the high 30s. So, you know, the ability for them to gain profit margin is just much greater than ours. And since, what, the early 70s, they've replaced us as that swing producer. They can simply
out-produce us. We're now the swing producer.
We are a swing producer. I would argue we're not the swing producer. I still think the Saudis wear that mantle.
Well, I'm going to. Okay. That's why we have these discussions.
That's right. Yeah, sure.
I think, there have been five times since 1980 that oil price has dropped in half or greater. Okay, and the biggest and the most severe was 85, 84, 85, 86. The market then was oversupplied by 15 million barrels. Now we come up to 2014, and we're oversupplied by 1.5 million barrels, 10% of, that's all. Okay, the Saudis said then, they said, we are not going to lose market share. We are going to continue to produce. We're the ones, the United States was the one that oversupplied the market.
See, I would, I take a different view and argue that it's got less to do with oversupply and under demand on the part of the Chinese and say that it is purely market manipulation by the Saudis for political gain, that their oil is being used as a weapon, not as a as a commodity on the open market.
Okay, let me have my
one minute.
The demand was good, and it's good today. Demand is up 1.5 million barrels a day. And we now have worked off the oversupply. And but all the rigs have shut down. Well, the United States went from 4 million barrels a day. We peaked in 70, 10 million barrels. Then came 73 embargo. And then down we went. We kept, because we were drilling all vertical wells and conventional reservoirs, most found with geophysics and all, and it was, I know, I listen, you're in the trenches, I know where that was. I'm in the trenches trying to...
For a different reason.
I'm trying to find oil. And it's getting more, more, and more expensive to find it. Okay, so then along, I'm one of the guys who said peak oil is here. And the world has peaked and will start to decline. That was before horizontal drilling. And that's what changed
the whole thing. That's been a magnificent surprise that we've experienced.
Oh, so we get 4 million barrels and we start building it back at 1 million barrels a year, a day, every year. We come back up to 9.7 million barrels. I would have bet and given big odds we would have never had anything like that.
And to your earlier point, we're certainly not at that today. I mean, with the companies that have shut down, we're somewhere in the 8.5 range.
You're more than that. But we're coming up on 8.5. But let me say this, that the companies that shut down, the oil didn't shut down.
No.
It just went in the hands of other people. And so it's, but what happens is, you go in there and drill a horizontal hole, it's 5,000, they're drilling out 20,000 now. And you frack it 20, 30, 40, 50 times in the horizontal hole, and then it goes on production. Well, it declines rapidly. I let me give you an experience, okay, May last year, so a year ago, I completed a well for 1,200 barrels a day, and oil was $48 a barrel and declining. That well went on May of last year. And so December, it's been on a year now, but in December after May and 6 months on, it cost $4.8 million and the well paid out. But today, 1 year later, that 1,200 barrel well is 200 barrels a day, but it paid out. And so the decline is severe. And we'll see your 8.5 pretty soon.
Well, and we're hopeful, I mean, SAFE and I suppose the rest of the nation, that when this Saudi exercise is over, that, that we will once again rise from the ashes and you know, there'll be a resurgence of these companies or others maybe that have bought them out.
But
they'll continue with that supply.
But generally, they're not oversupplying the market today.
The Saudis?
No, they're producing 10.2 barrels, 10.2 million barrels a day. They got up to 10.8, and I called it. I said, no, they're selling. They're not selling 10.8. They're calling it production, but they use a lot of it internally. Okay, they're pulling it out of storage. I do not think the Saudis can produce 10.8. And they tell you they 11 and a half, 12 and a half. Nobody's ever seen it.
Yep.
And I kept saying at 10, I said they can't. It's not sustainable for them at 10. They can't do it. They decline at a different rate than we do because their reservoirs are water dry. Mm-hmm. And they're declining at 3-4% a year. But everybody that has oil experiences decline.
Sure.
And that's the toughest thing for a geologist is to maintain production. You look at Exxon today. Exxon has probably peaked last year. The only way they can ever come back up and not be in decline is to acquire something.
Innovation, perhaps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so decline, it mm-hmm. will get you. Mm-hmm. And so here you are. See, the United States had 1,609 rigs running in November 14. And I said, we'll drop 1,000 rigs like that. Today, it's 342.
It's okay. Even worse than what you just
said. Well, I knew it'd come on down, but I knew you'd drop 1,000 right quick. You will never in America have 1,609 rigs running again because a lot of those rigs have been taken out of service and been cannibalized.
Well, see, our frustration, getting to the essence of your question, is that, you know, here we are, the most powerful country in the world economically and militarily, and yet we've been at the end of that whipsaw effect now for over 18 months. And again, this Saudi, you know, global national energy strategy has impacted us in ways that are even more severe than we anticipated. So that's driven in part SAFE's logic in making this national energy strategy recommendation. And basically, to answer your original question, it's a menu, okay, of opportunities for the federal government in particular. But I would argue,
they take no role.
Our growth has been through commercial and free American enterprise.
That's
okay?
Right.
We're trying to get them to assume a greater role.
But what kills us, the industry, is EPA.
Well, we're trying to use the MPA, the EPA,
to
be more reasonable and efficient and effective in what they do. Okay, we're not there yet, and whether or not they take
there is a role
remains to be.
There is
absolutely,
absolutely
a role. But we're sort of stretched between the free market enterprise aspect of things and government involvement, and I think we've always been, you know, nonpartisan. So we're trying to get the best of both worlds there to work together. Whether it's going to happen or not remains to be seen.
Okay.
But we think there's some things that can be done.
Okay, so what's the alternative to fossil fuels? You've got Hillary Clinton saying the same thing as Bernie does, but we want to get rid of all fossil fuels.
Yeah. Well, I just think that's just bad head work. I mean, you know, gasoline is just way too efficient and way too integrated into our culture and will be for, you know, long after you and I are gone to say that we can simply get rid of it. In fact, I work with some coal folks who say that what's happened to the coal industry is also patently unfair. Okay, I got it with regard to clean energy and all of that, but clean energy is not ready to replace coal.
When you say clean energy, you're talking about renewables?
Renewables for the most part, that would say, you know, solar and
wind
and those types of things. I mean, I just don't think that they're mature enough yet or efficient enough that they can ever totally replace coal. Now, do we need cleaner coal? Do we need innovation and breakthrough there? To clean the carbons? Absolutely. But if we spent the same amount of money trying to clean up coal that we're spending trying to get these others stood up, the problem would have been solved, you know, a few years ago.
You remember who decided to, because they didn't like the Russians, that they're going to get rid of fossil fuels? The Germans. You remember what they did?
Oh, yeah, sure.
The wind and solar.
Yeah.
And they're in a bad spot for both of them.
Yeah.
The sun isn't good, and the wind isn't either.
Only in the Alps, yeah.
Yeah, in the United States, we have the best wind corridor in the world, from Sweetwater, Texas, to the Canadian border, and we have so much in the way of resources. You start to think divine intervention.
we're a blessed country.
We really have more than anybody does.
That's right, more than anybody. And,
yeah.
and that's, again, to why we want to have a national energy strategy/plan. And we think that it's just within the state of the art. What we recommended is a host of things that will endeavor to get us off this 92% reliance. SAFE has a bumper sticker, Boone, that says basically 50 by 40. And what that means is that by the year 2040, we want to drop that 92% by 50%. So it'll be somewhere in the range of, what, 45% or so.
That can be accomplished.
We think it can. We think it can. One of the things that the report really stresses is the innovation associated with autonomous vehicles coming online now. And the fact that most of those are advanced fuel vehicles, I'll dare say electric vehicles, and that's got tremendous potential if it's adopted on a wide scale to get us to that 50%. So there's a number of things that talk about light-duty vehicles and heavy-duty vehicles and autonomous vehicles that's in the report, a series of recommendations, if you will, that would involve industry and involve government and involve state and local governments as well for establishing accelerated communities where they would create the conditions so that we could test really and hopefully, you know, prosper these things toward a successful conclusion that the government would have to be involved in. We're looking to adjust the subsidy program. Right now, a person who prospectively is going to buy an electric vehicle can get a $7,500 subsidy. But we've scratched our head and asked ourselves, should we be subsidizing rich folks so they can buy a Tesla? The answer to that is no.
No.
We need to phase that part of it out.
Right.
And only vehicles that would cost less than $55,000 would get that subsidy.
Well, there's one that you don't focus on, mm-hmm. and it's a big ticket item, is the heavy-duty trucks in
mm-hmm.
America.
Yep.
Okay, the 18-wheelers.
Yep.
There's only two fuels that move them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it with a battery.
No, that's not even an objective.
It's diesel frankly. Or natural diesel, gas.
Natural gas, that's right.
Yeah. And if you took those off diesel, mm-hmm. that would clear up 3 million barrels of oil a day.
Also clean up the environment. You know, would help us get at that. There's a whole host of reasons to do that, and heavy-duty vehicles are a significant part of the focus. And vis-a-vis natural gas, we recommended federal investment, and it can come from a host of ways. We can talk about the royalties program in a moment. But basically, we're asking the government, not through supporting winners and loser companies, okay, but through, no kidding, national laboratories and universities, to do more work for batteries on the electrical side and natural gas storage tanks on the heavy duty side, so that those things can prosper again in a shorter period of time.
You said royalties.
Yeah.
Tell me
what we've recommended to the president, and he even mentioned it in the State of the Union now two years ago, is a program that would open up federal lands for additional drilling and exploration to include off coast in the Eastern Gulf. And the money made from those adventures would see a certain portion of that income set aside as royalties for this research, so that it's not hitting the taxpayer with new taxes or whatever.
It's taking
new opportunities and taxing a part of that, setting it aside as royalties for the research.
Okay, royalties for the research. Does it cost the operator of the property, or is the government going to take part of their royalty and use it?
I think the latter, but I'm not prepared to say that it isn't some of both. Okay, the thought process would be that the purpose for opening up those new lands would be to achieve some reinvestment, if you will, from what's made available there, so that we can prosper these other forms of energy.
Those lands, to this mm-hmm. geologist, mm-hmm. are a long way in the future,
mm-hmm.
because you have plenty on shore
mm-hmm.
that's cheaper to mm-hmm. develop. And so you don't go to the deep water
mm-hmm.
and you don't go offshore, because those are more expensive.
Yep. I understand, of course, and that might be the outcome, but at this point, we're still in that inventory stage of trying to get the government to even, you know, entertain the idea. We have certain...
Did you get any interest?
Well, yes, but when you start talking specific location and specific amounts, you've got people raising their hand in the air with a stop sign. We have some folks in the Congress who would like to see the Alaskan areas opened. But that's a political hot potato, and I just don't know that that's going to be part of the...
But you don't need it.
Those folks would like to see it happen that are supporting the idea, whether or not we need it in the final analysis.
Well, Alaska loves to see it happen because it helps their economy.
Mm-hmm. That's part of it, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to change the direction here. Right. And, all of us, you, us, and of course you know so much about it, more about it mm-hmm. than we do, but ISIS, let me give you my perspective because mm-hmm. it'll be very brief.
Please.
They don't even own a tank. They don't have a boat. Yeah. They don't have an airplane.
Yeah.
They got a bunch of pickup trucks that were sold secondhand somewhere to them, and I bet you most of them came out of the United States.
They captured a lot from the Iraqi army when they turned tail.
Okay. But those things look like pickup trucks.
Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah, they're gun-mounted. Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. and so they're not formable, mm-hmm. but they're sure a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
When they can blow people up and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I know that guy in Garland, Texas, that his name's Gregory Stevens. I don't know whether you saw him or not, but he's the guy that they came to kill the group there that had done cartoons of Mohammed. And he was Garland Police Department. Huh? And it was just, all it took was two shots.
Two good shots, by the way.
He got them both.
Yeah, from what I read.
Yeah, they jumped out and started to fire, and he dropped some both.
Wrong guy.
He did use, said he used another shot. He said one of them wiggled, and he shot him again.
This guy would have made a good Texas Ranger back in the day.
He was an impressive guy. Yeah, I know him. I know him.
They've kept his identity.
Okay,
sort
now
of
tell
restricted.
Me yeah. what's going to happen.
Okay.
You know why his name came out? Because these two guys came from Phoenix mm-hmm. to Garland. Garland is a suburb of Dallas.
Check.
And they came to do the job. This guy in Arizona trained them to shoot and whatever else they got trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up someplace in communications, and he's now on trial, and they had to bring Gregory Stevens in for that.
I had not seen the rest of the story. That's really interesting.
I
appreciate you telling me that. ISIS. Again, we need to back up and take a look. In my estimate, ISIS is the tactical or operational problem. Islamic extremism throughout virtually every Muslim country is the strategic problem. And it exists, you know.
But they don't have a tank, a boat, or an airplane.
No. But they support the ISIS, okay, to some greater or lesser degree. Those in particular in Saudi Arabia supported the Al-Qaeda with huge amounts of funds over the years. Okay, if you take them separately, what can we do about Islamic extremism in the Muslim countries? Nothing, okay? Western influence will not fix that. That's got to be done from within. And the good news is those leaders now realize it. For years, their methodology for treating the radicalized youth was to send them to the mountains of Pakistan or maybe the Syrian border, give them a weapon and give them a chance to kill an American. And when you get that silliness out of your system, come back, enjoy the good life, and spend daddy's money. That didn't work. Those people stayed radicalized, and they redirected their hate towards the leadership in some of those countries. And they now realize that, and that's why they're as active as they are, in Syria in particular, but potentially even in Iraq, to get rid of the ISIS, which is, again, sort of the extension of Islamic extremism. The guys in the field.
Out front crowd.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, to your point, ISIS is not long for this world because nobody likes ISIS, okay? They have no natural allies. And it's simply a matter of time before we finally get our stuff together.
I thought they were Sunnis.
And go after them. They are, for the most part. But and frankly, at one point in Iraq, when they moved in from Syria, the Sunnis said, go ahead. We need to send a strong message to Mr. Maliki, who is our prime minister in Baghdad anyway, so you guys go ahead. And they did, and Maliki only lasted a month or two after they started taking large chunks of Iraq. Well, what happened then is that they started to say, okay, well, we're establishing the new caliphate, and this portion of Western Iraq is it.
And it staked out a pretty big area.
They did, and they started going loggerheads with the tribal chiefs, the Sunni tribal chiefs.
Yeah, but you look at what they staked out.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't very attractive.
Terrain, yeah. No, it's along the rivers, which at least gave them fresh water. So ISIS is entirely doable. But we got to get serious about it. And time is not on our side.
Are you going to have to go back in?
Well, to a degree, okay? And I would add a qualification. I think that you've got the resident forces in Iraq to make it happen. We need to do a better job. Iraq and the current Iraqi government, even the one that replaced Maliki, is infiltrated completely by Iranians. And they're calling the shots, largely, you know, what happens in the rest of the country. Boone, if we could put direct feeds of weapons and support into the Sunni tribes and do the same with the Kurds, this thing would be over in a month in Iraq. But the Iraqi government won't let us do that, and we're having to play by their rules at this point.
I hate to see our people go back in there.
Well, the way we ought to do it is if this were a NATO operation, okay, we would gather all the nations that have an interest, and now I'm talking about Egypt and Saudi Arabia and UAE and Bahrain and all the Gulf Coast countries, because, again, they see themselves as maybe those guys in the orange jumpsuit someday if they don't get rid of this menace. But we ought to gather those people together and say, okay, here's the plan. By the way, you also have to take care of the political aspect of this thing where it relates to Syria. You have to agree with them on what's in state in Syria politically. What will you accept and what's not acceptable?
This is the guy that everybody...
Assad, yeah.
You got to get rid of him. And now he's become...
Well, see, that's part of the problem. This was inherently easier before the Russians came in, because then the only extra national support that Assad had was the Iranians. And they don't project power all that well. The Russians do. So now that you've got Iran and Assad and Russia on one side of the fence and the U.S. and Turkey and the other, you know, Arab nations in the region on the other side, achieving that end state is going to be real hard. It's making Syria in some ways a quagmire. But back to the point, once we can understand with at least our partners and friends what we think the thing ought to look like in its finality and end state, in a NATO operation, we would say, okay, what can you contribute and what are your shortfalls? And we would make up the shortfalls. Now, traditionally, that would be command and control, satellite communications and intelligence.
Not
strategic
on the front line.
No, this is all, yeah. You know, strategic
but
level
it's,
stuff.
But it's still not a, it's a danger position.
It is. We might be required to provide armor support or artillery support, but to my way of thinking, the qualifier ought to be, we are not going to provide guys kicking down doors. Okay, if this is important to you, you're going to have to make that investment. We can do the other things. Let's sign the agreement and go.
Kicking down doors. I was with General John Campbell.
Yep.
You know him.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Okay, and we were at the SALT conference together, mm-hmm. and we were talking, and I said, gosh, our people are there. Now, he said, well, you need to understand, there were other countries, mm-hmm. and I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shows you think, well, yep. You think you know a little bit about this. You don't know much about it. He said 42 countries.
Some just have a almost handful. Symbolic representation. Others are more serious about it. And there are
and he said some gave money.
They did?
Yeah.
And some countries actually have more aggressive rules of engagement than we do. We've had to pull some of them back because they're out there doing pretty good work. So
you already pull them back.
Yeah, you can. You say, hey, you're going to violate the international laws here of a warfare, and that'll get their attention. But anyway, it's all doable. But I would not advocate that we be sending in large numbers of ground troops to fight their war for them yet once again. Okay.
Well, General,
great seeing you again as always, sir. Happy birthday.
Good. Thank you. Thank
okay.
you.
They enjoyed our discussion.
Those birthdays are yet more important all
the time.
You know,
I try to ignore mine anymore. I just see,
you
know.
You can't do that.
Well,
it won't work.
That's what people tell me. We're going to recognize whether you want to or not. Yes, sir.
Good.